comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful planet we call Earth, thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. Every night on the show, as I'm sure our regular listeners have noticed, I always urge people to subscribe to the K-Files e-zine, to our free weekly newsletter. And the reason I encourage you to do that night after night is because some of you hear it night after night and don't do it, and I know what you're missing. You don't, but I do. Another reason is we have new listeners every night, and they don't even know about it yet. So we have a free weekly newsletter. We send it out via email. It is called The K-Files. And it's got inside scoop, the inside information from here at the show. It's also got interesting articles that have something to do with our genre. And links to interesting videos and reader or audience feedback. Always a free download, and it's just a good publication. Hey, it's free, really free. No strings attached, really. No strings attached. No tricks, no strings attached. It's free. And we don't share our email list with anybody. You know, we don't rent it out or sell it or lease it or loan it or any of that stuff. Never have and never will. So you're not going to be spammed as a result of having subscribed to the K-Files. And I really recommend that you do it. It's a good publication. You don't know what you're missing. I do, but why don't you find out? So you just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and click where it says K-Files, and then you can subscribe. It's really that simple. It takes a few seconds, and then you're in. And it doesn't cost you anything. You know, one of the things that always really ticks me off on the internet when I respond to something that says, okay, we're going to give you this free ebook, or we're going to give you this free newsletter, and then you sign up, and then they say, it pops up and says, just one more step, and then you have to recommend three friends, recommend it to three friends or five friends or something like that. Well, see, that's not free. You're working for it. That's not free. This is free. We don't make you do that. So if you're not subscribed, be sure you do. Tonight, we're going to be talking about UFO interaction with the military, specifically the U.S. military. I have two guests on tonight, Robert Hastings and Robert Salas. And these two guests are men who have spoken out quite a lot about UFO interaction with the military. Robert Hastings, of course, has written much and spoken much about it. Robert Salas, as well, has spoken much about it. Robert Salas is also an eyewitness to just such an incident. We'll be back right after this. Thank you. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, my guest this evening, and I've got two guests with us, Robert Hastings and Robert Salas, and each of them has quite a track history in speaking about the interactions between UFOs and the U.S. military. So, first of all, let me welcome each of you to the Kevin Smith Show. Robert Hastings, welcome back to the show. You've been with us before, and we're glad you're back.
Thanks for having me. I sure appreciate it.
And Robert Salas, this is your first time to be with us, but thank you, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be on. Thank you, Kevin.
For those who may be just stepping into our genre and maybe not really up to speed on who's who within our genre, Robert Hastings is a researcher and lecturer on UFOs. And since 1973, he's been interviewing former and retired military personnel regarding their knowledge of UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites, and presented his findings at over 500 colleges and universities nationwide since 1981. Robert Salas is formerly in the U.S. Air Force. He's a captain in the U.S. Air Force. He spent 7 years in active duty from 1964 to 1971. He's also held positions at Martin Marietta and Rockwell, and spent 21 years at the FAA. In the Air Force, he was an air traffic controller and a missile launch officer, as well as an engineer on the Titan III missiles. Both of you talk about and write, in your case, Robert Hastings, you've written a lot about and spoken a lot about, and Robert Salas, you've spoken a lot about UFO activity around these nuclear missile sites. Recently, there was kind of a cool development in that Pravda, a Russian newspaper, picked up something that you wrote, Robert Hastings, and ran it and published it and ran it, and they have a readership of something like 2 million people, and it was about UFOs. Tell us about that.
Well, the newspaper in Russia is called Life, and I don't believe that's Pravda per se. The English translation of Pravda is Truth, if I'm not mistaken. In any case, about 2 weeks ago, I was contacted by a Russian reporter named Inessa Kornienko, who works for this Life newspaper, mm-hmm. has a 2 million readership. And in any case, she was writing a story about an incident that took place in Soviet Ukraine during the Cold War in October of 1982, in which a UFO, a saucer-shaped object, was observed by countless military people and townspeople nearby as it came in and hovered over this nuclear missile base. And the story that has emerged over time from eyewitnesses, former and retired Soviet military personnel, is that while this object was hovering over one of these launch capsules, a number of nuclear missiles suddenly activated without any authorization from Moscow, without any actions being taken by the launch officers. No codes were input, no keys were turned. And apparently for 15 seconds, these missiles were preparing to launch. And then suddenly the anomaly ceased and everything returned to normal. Now, that story first broke in 1994. A reporter named George Knapp, Las Vegas television reporter, was in the former Soviet Union interviewing former military people about UFO activity and heard about that incident. That material was subsequently shared with ABC News, and they more or less ran with the ball and publicized this incident that I just described in a segment of Primetime Live. What happened most recently in this Life newspaper interview, Kornienko interviewed new witnesses, corroborated even further that this did indeed take place. and contacted me to ask me my impression of the case, whether I thought it was credible. I told her it was, based on my knowledge of it. I also gave her information about a nearly identical case that occurred at Malmstrom Air Force, or excuse me, Minot Air Force Base in 1966, in which apparently a number of nuclear missiles were temporarily activated as a UFO was sighted hovering above each of the missiles. And I got that directly from a launch officer named David Shure. I published his account in my book, UFOs and Nukes. And so, yes, what seemingly has taken place on both sides of the ocean is UFO interference with our nuclear missile systems.
And this was a couple of weeks ago that this ran?
The Soviet or mm-hmm. Russian article was published on June 16th, and I've recently posted on UFO Chronicles website an article in which there is an English translation of the Russian article, basically summarizing everything I've just said. And if one searches for recent Russian newspaper article on UFO activity in the Soviet Union and the U.S., you'll see that full-length translation of the original Russian article.
All right, Robert Salas, first of all, let me thank you for your years of service to the country. And I don't know if anybody ever tells you thank you for that, but they should. And it is appreciated. But now let me ask you about the incident that got you into the stream of this genre of talking about UFOs and military. You were involved in one of these incidents, were you not?
Yes. This was 1967. I was a missile launch officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base. We had Minuteman 1 missiles at the time. And I was on duty at what we call Oscar Flight, and we're pretty sure the date was March 24th, 1967. We've got corroboration on that date. So, and at any rate, I'm on duty, and I get a call from my upstairs guard that they've been seeing some strange lights overhead and making strange maneuvers, stopping on a dime, reversing course, that sort of thing. And they just wanted to report it. It's just kind of strange lights in the sky type of thing. Well, I didn't think much of it, and basically thanked them and hung up the phone. But, it was kind of strange because, you know, these are professional Air Force airmen, and we always took our communication seriously. So but about 5 minutes later or so, he calls back. This time he's screaming into the phone and saying, sir, there's a glowing red object, oval shape, hovering over the front gate. And he had all the security guards out there and wanted to know what to do next. I think I told him, don't let anything inside the perimeter fence. That was about the end of that conversation. He hung up because one of the guards had a slight injury to his hand. As I was about to wake my commander, Fred Meiwald, who was on a rest break, tell him about these phone calls, suddenly we got these bells and whistles going off and lights going off on the console, the status console that shows the status of the missiles, and they all started going fault or no-go. So,
okay, so, and I'm assuming that means that basically your ability to launch had been switched off.
Exactly.
By whatever means, but it had been nullified.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I recall all 10 of them going down. Fred Meiwald thinks there were maybe 8, but nonetheless, this was going on while this object was above our launch control facility. And to understand that the guards up there had no ability to control any of the functions of the missiles from upstairs, so they couldn't have perpetrated any kind of a hoax or anything from up there. And that's why I believe what they had told me about this subject, because there's no way they could have faked this thing. At any rate, the missile system is a very reliable system. We had state-of-the-art technology at the time, and nothing even close to that ever happened in the 3 years I was there. So we did lose our missiles, or 10 missiles, while this object was up there. And the other part of this, important part of this story, is that after my commander reported to command post, he turned to me and he said, the same thing happened in another flight. And for a long, long time, I thought it was the same thing happened that day at another flight. But as it turns out later, after doing all the research we've done, it turns out Echo Flight went down about a week earlier under very similar circumstances, UFOs being reported over the launch facilities in that case. And why we think our case is a strong one is because we've got living witnesses that were capsule commanders and deputy commanders at both facilities that can testify to the facts, as I've just told you.
Now, when you talk about upstairs and downstairs, and what we're talking about is that, I think what we're talking about is that where you worked is underground.
Right, right. 60 feet underground.
Okay. So when you talk about upstairs, you're talking about people that are up on ground level.
That's right, that's right. Sorry, I should have explained that. But right. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so and the reason I wanted to clarify that is these people are your eyes and ears as to what's going on out there on the surface, because you're underground. You don't have any windows that you can look out of.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. And we didn't have any video systems. I've had that question a lot. We didn't have video up there at the time. So, no, I didn't see the object myself, but I certainly felt the effects of it. Like I said, and after researching this, after I went public and we started researching it, by the way, my researcher was James Klotz, and he's also the co-author of our book, Faded Giant, where I, you know, talked about all this. We found out that there was an extensive investigation of all this, and that the Boeing investigators were unable to come up with a reason for the shutdowns to occur.
Okay, why would Boeing be involved in this if this is U.S. Air Force?
Yeah, Boeing is a prime contractor for the Minuteman missile, and they were asked to send their experts to form an investigation team, and so they did.
So, in other words, Boeing built the system?
I wouldn't go that far. but Boeing was a prime contractor, let's say. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there were other contractors involved. Right now, I don't recall who the other contractors were, although Sylvania, I know, was one.
Yeah, Sylvania.
Sylvania.
If I can interject here, Kevin, to put all of this in context, over the last 30 years, I have interviewed launch officers who were at other Air Force bases involved with nuclear missiles, from Atlas missiles to Titans to Minutemen, and they've told me variations on this same story. As early as 1964, 3 years before the incident described by Bob Salas, down at Walker Air Force Base at Roswell, New Mexico, there was a squadron of Titan of Atlas missiles, and I've interviewed, I would say, six or eight people, including launch officers who were involved, who said they got calls from their guards topside saying there's a strange object hovering over the sites, shining a light down on it. And one of these gentlemen, Jerry Nelson, the launch officer, said that this happened on roughly half a dozen occasions over a month period. The object was completely silent, was extremely bright, and was shining a spotlight directly down on the missile. And there were a number of guards that reported down to him, and he said you could tell quite obviously that they were terrified. Their voices were trembling. I've heard variations on that story at Minot Air Force Base, at F.E. Warren Air Force Base, at Ellsworth Air Force Base. One of the most dramatic cases that I present in my book involves a man named John Mills, who is a retired missile targeting person, and he was out working on a site at Ellsworth Air Force Base in December of 1978, and he's down below with his commander doing this alignment procedure for the missile, and suddenly the guard topside starts screaming, "Get up here now," and he's banging on the ladder with his flashlight to get their attention, and he ruins this very sensitive measurement that they're taking. So they're pissed off, they're going up the ladder ready to kill this kid, and they get up there and they hear this very deep humming sound that is unlike anything they've ever heard. He said you could feel it in your inside you, it was like your teeth were vibrating. You could feel it reflecting off various structures on the site. And finally the kid starts screaming and they all look up, and long story short, they basically see a diamond-shaped object. It was angular. It had four sides, black. It was not illuminated, but you could tell its presence because it cast a silhouette where you could see the stars all around it. And so it's making this huge vibrating sound, and all of a sudden the missile malfunctions. And they attempt to restart it. They cannot restart it. And then they get a call from the base, Ellsworth, saying, "Get back here now." John Mills says that when they got back to the missile maintenance hangar, he said that every colonel on base was there, it seemed. There were other targeting teams, including his. They had had similar experiences. They were all separated and individually debriefed.
All right, we have to step away for a break. And we'll pick up with this story right there when we come back. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Robert Hastings and Robert Salas. And we're talking about UFOs interaction with the military, principally the U.S. military, although we've also talked a little bit about UFOs interaction with the former Soviet military. When we went away, Robert Hastings, you were telling us about they were recalled to they were told to get back to Ellsworth, and when they got there, all these colonels were assembled, and then we had to go to break. So why don't you pick up there and tell us the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say.
Well, just to finish a thought, John Mills, who is a retired Air Force sergeant and missile targeting person, said that when they were ordered back to base, they were debriefed, basically told not to talk about this. And he later learned that one of the teams was bragging about what they saw. They disappeared. They were no longer at the base. They got shipped elsewhere. And he said several months later, when things calmed down, he was approached by a couple of targeting officers who were probing him about what he knew. And he knew that three missiles had gone down. They told him that basically 12 or 13 missiles had gone down that night. In other words, their guidance and control systems had malfunctioned. They were unlaunchable, and that UFOs had been sighted over several of the sites. I simply mentioned the cases that these various bases to put into context. What Bob is saying is not an isolated case by any means. I think I sort of jumped in on his story, and I know he's got more to say about what he happened to him.
Well, before we get back to Bob, let me nail down, what year was this incident with Ellsworth?
John Mills said it had to have occurred between December of 78 and New Year's. He was teamed with a temporary targeting officer because his regular officer was out on Christmas break. So he's got a good reference for the time frame.
All right. Now, Bob Salas, yes. This incident that took place at Maelstrom, and it took place, I believe you said, March the 24th, 1967.
That's right.
After this incident, were you subjected to this, all this kind of debriefing and keep your mouth shut and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, we sure were. We were ordered back to the base after we were relieved. We were helicoptered back, directed to go direct to our squadron commander's office. And as we walked in, everybody was confused about what was going on. I immediately went to my squadron commander and said, what the heck is going on? With this report and our missiles going down. And this guy was an ex-World War II B-17 pilot. He had seen a lot of action, and he was white as a sheet. He said, I don't know. This sure wasn't any kind of an Air Force exercise. But basically, we told them what had happened, and then but there happened to be a member of Air Force Office Special Investigation in the office with him, and he was there to get us to sign a document saying we would not talk about this to anyone ever. And so, which was kind of strange because we had above top secret clearance, as missile officers, but he wanted us to sign another document about this particular incident. Unbeknownst to us at the time, what was going on really was that there's a relationship here to the Kahn Committee investigation, and I'm sure you're probably familiar with that.
Yes.
Yep. But the Conant Committee got started, I think, late 1966, and by early 67 they were kind of in full swing. And they were investigating all possible UFO interactions with Air Force facilities at the time. And so the Air Force was very nervous about these sort of incidents. So that's kind of a backdrop. If we have time later on, I'd like to go into a little bit more detail on how the Conant Committee investigation kind of ties into what happened at Maelstrom.
Yeah, go ahead now.
Well, this investigator that we researched a little bit more on, it, his name is,
Roy Craig.
Roy Craig, Dr. Roy Craig. Thanks, Robert. He was actually got wind of the Echo and Oscar shutdowns in, I think it was August of 67, so a few months after the incidents. And he went to Maelstrom Air Force Base to supposedly these incidents and other related incidents that that had been reported. And when he got there, Lieutenant Colonel Lewis Chase, who was actually designated the UFO officer at Maelstrom Air Force Base, basically told Craig that no, there were no UFOs involved in any of this stuff, and that he didn't continue any kind of investigation. Well, Craig pretty much bought it and didn't bother to interview witnesses. We've got this documented, and he didn't interview witnesses, didn't follow through, and basically accepted what the Air Force was telling him. And what went back and reported back to Condon. But he did try to get a hold of a secret document, a secret investigation report that the Air Force has had written. But as it turns out, Dr. Robert Lowe was the only one that could review secret documents for the Condon team. So Lowe, after trying to get this document from Washington, was turned down, and Lowe dropped the ball. Also, he didn't follow through on that either. So I personally think that this was certainly part of the cover up of the Condon Committee, and of course, as you know, the Air Force decided not to further investigate UFOs as a result of that Condon report.
Well, so they say publicly.
Right, that's right, publicly.
Mm-hmm. There has been information that I've seen on the Internet and in some various books that have been published that many, if not all, but certainly many of these people that were on the Condon Committee were also on the CIA payroll.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't doubt it.
What about Robert Hastings? Have you seen any of that comment or material about the CIA connection to the Condon Committee?
Not per se. It's clear to me, if you look at what took place, there was a lot going on behind the scenes to bottle it up. For many years now, the Robert Lowe memorandum has been known, where publicly the Air Force-funded University of Colorado investigation was supposed to be an objective scientific study, but in one of the project coordinator, I don't know his exact title, but anyway, Dr. Robert Lowe was saying things behind the scene, you know, if we package this right, you know, it'll look like an objective study, whereas we know to begin with, you know, we're not going to find anything verifying UFOs. So quite unscientifically, they had their minds made up before they did any supposed objective study. Even the project director, Dr. Condon, made statements in lectures saying, I think there's nothing to UFOs, but I'm not supposed to arrive at that conclusion for another year. So quite incriminating comments were made by people supposedly doing an objective study. It's pretty clear what's important to keep in mind is that as documents have emerged over the years through the Freedom of Information Act, and as witnesses such as Mr. Salas and the people that I've interviewed have come forward one at a time, what's clear is that Project Blue Book, supposedly the high-powered study of UFOs on the part of the Air Force, was more or less a public relations exercise for most of its life, and the real investigation work was being done by intelligence and counterintelligence groups, including OSI, the Office of Special Investigations. And none of those cases were publicly acknowledged, with rare exceptions to the public, and they only trickled out, you know, that their involvement in these national security-related cases only trickled out decades later. So, yeah, there's been a lot of sleight of hand going on, you know. The Air Force and the government in general is saying, look over here. Meanwhile, they're doing things over there. And, you know, it's a classic spin being put on what the public is being told. I think it's important to add to what Bob Salas is saying, that one of the other witnesses who's talked about the shutdown that he was involved in, a targeting officer named Bob Jamieson, who appeared on Larry King with Bob Salas and myself back in July of 2008. I talked to Bob Jamieson 3 years before Bob Salas ever went public, and I had no way of knowing that Bob was going to talk about his incident. And yet Bob Jamieson was telling me back in 1992 about responding to a full-flight missile shutdown, 10 missiles going down, and being told that when they got to the missile maintenance hangar that there was UFO involvement. And the reason one of the reasons we can pin down this date of March 24th is Bob Jamieson has said that while they were waiting at the missile maintenance hangar to go out in the field and bring the Oscar flight missiles back up, He went to a temporary command post and heard over radio that another UFO had landed in a canyon near Malmstrom Air Force Base. And all the details that Jameson has provided make it quite clear that this was a famous incident called the Belt Landing, or the Belt Incident, Belt, Montana, little town near Malmstrom, which was publicized in the Great Falls papers the next day so we could pinpoint the date. And while Jameson was waiting in the hangar, his team and the other targeting teams were told that there was UFO activity involved with the shutdowns. They were instructed that if they saw a UFO on the way to the sites, to report it. If they saw a UFO when they were at the sites, the targeting teams were to get into what's called the personnel access hatch, go underground, leave their security guard topside, who could report on a radio what he was seeing. Jameson said that in the two or three or four missiles that he helped bring up, his team did not see a UFO, but the explicit instructions that he got from his commanders before going to the field was that this was a UFO shutdown and that you are going to stay here until all reports of UFO activity cease, and then we're going to let you go out in the field. So there are independent, you know, statements, corroboration of what Bob Salas has described occurring. And, you know, so this is quite a well-documented case.
All right. We're only about 15 seconds away from break. When we come back from break, I want to get into a little bit of what you, Bob Salas, have been, what you did when you left the Air Force. Got a couple of questions about that. We'll be back right after this. Okay, we are back, and just a quick reminder, if you are not subscribed to our newsletter, be sure you do. It's free. 623-444-5889 is the number we normally use when we open the telephone lines. Tonight, we may or may not open the telephone lines, depending on how deep our discussion goes here, because I have a lot of questions of these two very knowledgeable men about what I think is a very important subject, and that is UFOs monkeying around with military high tech. I think that's a pretty big story. It's we've heard about it. But here we've got two of the people that probably know more about this than any other individuals involved with it, because of their involvement personally and also their deep research into it. And I want to be sure that we get to hear as much as we can about all of this. Bob Salas, when we went away for break, I said, I want to ask you a couple of questions about after you finished your active duty with the Air Force. You went to, I believe, Martin Marietta, and you also held a position at Rockwell, and then the FAA for, I think, 21 years, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I was in aircraft certification at FAA.
All right. Now, when you were at Martin Marietta and Rockwell, was there ever any talk about UFOs?
No. Yeah, actually, I was only at Martin and Rockwell for about a year each.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Marietta was bidding on contracts for the space shuttle at the time. They were actually bidding on the manipulator arm. So I got a chance to work a little bit on that design, and then at Rockwell I worked again, continued working in the reliability field on the space shuttle bids. So that was the major thing going on. But no, nobody talked about UFOs.
Okay, now you're in aircraft certification over at FAA. What does that entail?
Well, that means we look at design changes, basically design new designs and design changes to aircraft that manufacturers would want to get approved. I worked with both the McDonnell Douglas aircraft and also Boeing designs and also worked with small airplanes at times.
All right.
I looked at structural drawings basically to check the structural integrity of the design.
Okay, so when you're at the FAA, you're hanging around with people, working with people that have all kinds of jobs, I guess, with the FAA, but primarily you're associated with people in your department. Mm-hmm. Any talk of UFOs in the FAA?
No talk of UFOs in the FAA. especially in my area, we were, you know, nuts and bolts engineer types, and the people that would have been involved with UFO reports would have been in air traffic, which was a separate, basically a separate group. So we really didn't communicate that much with them.
I can say I've interviewed half a dozen or so FAA controllers who were at Malmstrom in the 60s and 70s. I've got a whole chapter in my book devoted to their testimony. I tape all of my witnesses. What I have in the book are verbatim statements. What they've told me is they were tracking objects repeatedly at Malmstrom Air Force Base during the time frame that these incidents were going on out at the missile sites. They were tracking objects that were covering, 200 miles in just a few seconds, doing zigzag flight patterns, sometimes groups of objects, up to five objects being tracked at once. And I initially attempted to interview these people back in the early 70s, and ones that I got a hold of back then didn't want to talk to me at all. But with the passage of time, in the last 5 years or so, I've interviewed the guys who felt they had really nothing to lose after all these years. You may or may not recall, Kevin, that when I talked to you the last time I was on your program, I was actually a teenager. My dad was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base when Bob was out in the missile field. And three nights a week, I worked at the air traffic control tower. And what sparked my interest in this whole subject was one of the FAA controllers who I had made, I wouldn't say he was a friend, but he certainly was an acquaintance, pointed out to me one night that he was tracking five unidentified targets. And for the brief period, maybe a minute or two, that I stood in front of his scope, I was asking him a flurry of questions, and all he would say was that two jets had been launched to investigate and that I had to come back later and clean up. I was a custodian, as I said, a teenage custodian in the tower three nights a week. And when I came back later and tried to pursue the subject, he did not want to talk about it. I guess he felt that he had said too much. In any case, my father, who worked in what's called the SAGE building at Malmstrom, which had, among other things, military and FAA radar systems in this building, was part of a integrated radar system for North America to monitor potential Soviet incursions. In any case, long story short, my father, when he heard what I told him about the radar tracking, made an inquiry without my asking him to. I never would have presumed to, but some person told him that these were five Soviet surveillance aircraft. That's the first story he got. And I said, Dad, you know, these were hovering. I was told they were hovering, and what I saw were hovering on the screen. You know, quite clearly, even if five Soviet spy planes got across Canada and into Montana airspace, they wouldn't be hovering. So this doesn't make sense. And some days later, he just very cryptically said, well, the talk around the building now is that these were bona fide UFOs and that they were near missile sites at Judith Basin. Now, the missile location where Bob Salas was and the other flight at Echo are further east of the Judith Basin area. So if that information that he got was correct, the objects that I saw were being tracked closer to Great Falls, closer to Malmstrom Air Force Base. But it was at still that same spring, March 67 time frame.
Why do you think, because, and I'm asking you, Robert Hastings, why do you think the FAA is so consistently silent? Or sometimes, this is my opinion, sometimes obviously lying when they say, no, we didn't have anything on our screen.
I'd like to interject after your answer, Robert. Go ahead.
I would simply say there's a number of factors. UFOs are kind of a taboo subject. They always have been, and some people really don't want to risk their jobs by talking about a taboo subject. There are other cases, though, where quite clearly a cover-up was involved. For example, the most famous case, in November of 87, this huge UFO was tracked in Alaska on several military and civilian radars. The tapes, the radar tapes, the voice tapes, apparently were kept at the FAA headquarters in Washington, and at some point, according to a retired FAA supervisor named John Callahan, at one point the CIA and other people in the Reagan administration showed up at FAA headquarters, and basically one of the CIA agents present said, we want all of your data, and you are never to discuss this incident. This never happened. We were not here. And when Callahan objected, and apparently in terms of the pecking order, the flow chart at the FAA, he was in one of the top five slots. He said that when he objected to the CIA's attempt to suppress all this, he said, you know, why? You know, why can't we talk about this UFO track on radar? And John Callahan said the CIA agent said there would be public panic if the facts were made known. And to his credit, in my opinion, John Callahan kept some of the data. He gave the CIA agent some of the tapes, some of the radar data, voice tapes, but he kept some of it, and after he retired, he released it to researchers. So in that instance, you have a clear-cut case of a CIA-orchestrated cover-up of a UFO radar track.
Okay, now, Bob Salas, you wanted to interject something there?
Oh, yeah, just very briefly. While I was FAA, I did find out that the FAA had secret files, and I asked the question, I guess this is while I was at headquarters for maybe a short period, why the FAA had reason to have secret files.
All right, hold that thought. We've got to step away for break. When we come back, we'll find out about the FAA secret files. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and a special welcome to those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour. I am deeply sympathetic and sorry for whatever it is that kept you away from the first hour, but we're glad you're here now. We're talking with Robert Hastings and Robert Salas, both of them, I would say, experts when it comes to the topic of UFO interaction with the military. And Robert Salas, when we went away for break, you were just beginning to tell us about some secret files at the FAA.
Yes. But that's about the end of the story. I know I found out that there were secret files while I was stationed at FAA headquarters in Washington, D.C. for a short time, and but that's about it. I was as much as I tried, I couldn't find out why the Air Force had any need. The FAA had any need for secret files.
Did you ask anybody about it?
I sure did.
What did they tell you?
Couldn't get a straight answer.
I am shocked, surprised, astounded.
there's no doubt that there have been many PIREPs or pilot reports of UFO sightings, and the FAA simply did not. You know, at the time, FAA did have a lot of open files because we tracked defects in various aircraft and various parts, and that whole database was open to the basically the public, so we could track and monitor what was going on with various aircraft. Certainly they didn't have any of the UFO reports in any of these files, and I did look from time to time for UFO reports, but never found any.
Robert Hastings, you have focused primarily upon UFO interactions with the U.S. military, but in your research, you've told us about this one that took place in the old Soviet Union. Have you run across any accounts outside the U.S. other than that one?
I'm aware of reports alleging that there have been UFO sightings around nuclear weapons facilities, reactors, primarily in Iran, in Pakistan, both of which are atomic nuclear powers, but I really have no first-hand sources that I can say. I've interviewed people. I have a good feel that, you know, I have a good sense of what really did or did not take place. It's hard enough tracking down people over the decades who were involved here in the U.S., and I simply don't have a lot of contacts outside the country. Now, I have to say, one rare exception to that, not even a week ago, I got a letter from an email from a retired Polish military intelligence officer who, to my satisfaction, is credible, and he told me of UFO activity in basically Soviet-occupied Poland during the Cold War era, where objects were being reported at weapons storage areas where nuclear warheads for missiles were stored. And the kinds of descriptions that he was getting through the grapevine, he was not directly involved in the investigations, but worked with people who were. You had objects that were silent, that were doing, hovering over and moving over weapons storage areas and sending down beams of light into them. There was a very famous case in England from December of 1980, the Bentwaters case at RAF, Royal Air Force Base in Bentwaters in England. And the most credible source there is Colonel Charles Holt, who was deputy base commander, who has described sending down beams of light, sending down beams of light into the weapons storage area there, and hearing radio check from the guards at the site saying that that was taking place. Now, thus far in the program tonight, we've not mentioned the fact that on September 27th, Mr. Salas and I are co-hosting a press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and among the people who would be participating in this are former launch officers like Mr. Salas, who were involved in UFO-related incidents at nuclear missile sites. In addition, Colonel Holt, who I just mentioned in conjunction with the Bentwaters case, is going to be a participant. In short, we have individuals that were entrusted by the U.S. government with weapons of mass destruction, either guarding them or operating them, and they're coming forward slowly but surely and saying that UFOs have monitored our nuclear weapons and on occasion have interfered with their functionality. Quite obviously, we believe this is a front-page story, an important story that people everywhere need to know about. It's not ancient history. I've interviewed someone within the last 6 months. I'm not going to mention his name tonight, but he was a security policeman at a weapons storage area at Area 2 outside of Nellis Air Force Base, who has described for Mr. Salas and myself repeated UFO incidents within the last 2 or 3 years at Area 2. And so this is ongoing. The first reports that I've received from persons who were involved in these kinds of incidents go back to the 1940s, and the latest occurred within the last 2 years. So this is important. This is ongoing.
One of the things that Mr. Stubbs and I wanted to use our time tonight to mention is that we are attempting to get donations from persons who think that this is important, whether it's a dollar or more than a dollar. If a number of your listeners would contribute even $1 to support of this press conference, we have to fly all these people to Washington from their homes. We're talking several thousand dollars involved with getting them there, putting them up in a hotel, and so forth. And at my website, at ufohastings.com, there is a page that says press conference. If you open that, you'll see a way that you can contribute using PayPal. No amount is too small. As I said, if a large number of your listeners contributed $1 each, we would have more than enough to pay for getting these people to Washington. But we think that it's important that they talk to the national and international press about the reality of this situation. Fortunately, this Russian reporter that I mentioned last hour, Inessa Kornienko, who wrote this story in this large Russian newspaper 2 weeks ago about UFO activity at Soviet missile sites, is going to attend the press conference. So we've already gotten international interest in the press conference, but we are frankly having difficulty funding the event, and are simply asking for donations, no matter how modest, to help us get this event off the ground.
Tell us again the date of this press conference.
It's September 27th, 2010, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. So far, we have a total of 8 participants, including Mr. Salas, not including myself. And these are persons who are going to tell the assembled media that UFOs have been monitoring and occasionally tampering with nuclear weapons, both here and abroad. And again, if one wants to contribute to this, getting this event to occur, if you go to my website, ufohastings.com, go to the press conference page, you'll see a way via PayPal that one can contribute whatever amount of money. Now, we have set up an independent bank account dedicated solely to these funds. Assuming that we actually have a surplus of funds when it's over, that money will be dedicated or donated to a charity. Mr. Dallas and I will not make one penny on this for any skeptics or cynics out there who think this is some kind of ripoff. We're simply trying to use every way possible to get this message for the media, the reality of the situation involving UFOs and nukes.
All right, Bob Salas, I got a question for you.
Yes.
As Robert Hastings is talking, does his telephone sound disrupted to you?
Yes, it's breaking up a little bit.
Okay, and the reason I bring this up, sometimes folks think I'm making up stuff when I say that people get interfered with when they try to talk to us. It is not our connection. It is not our connection, period. Because, Bob Salas, you are on the exact same telephone line coming into this studio as Robert Hastings is on. It's a three-way call, and you're crystal clear. So I don't know, Robert Hastings, if are you using some type of VOIP system?
No, like, as I mentioned to you this afternoon, I am on a cell phone. I live out in the desert northwest of Taos, New Mexico, and there is no landline service.
Mm-hmm.
So it would not surprise me if there is a cell phone issue involved in this particular case. On the other hand, if I've been crystal clear until the last couple of minutes, and that's a little odd, I have had problems with telephone surveillance over the years. I actually had someone tell me, a policeman, detective in Myrtle Beach in 1982, who obviously was in the loop to the point that he knew my phone had been tapped and told me so. And when I would interview ex-military personnel over the phone, and then the interview would be finished, invariably within a few minutes I would get a call, someone on the other end saying nothing, and they would hang up. And that happened like clockwork after my interviews with ex-military persons. Whoever they are, CIA, NSA, I don't know. They're just sending a message, I think, saying, we know who you're talking to. Don't get too big for your britches, Mr. Hastings. So But that happened almost without fail for many, many years. So there have been legitimate telephone issues related to my pursuit of this subject matter.
Yeah. All right. Now, we started off with this story that was published a couple of weeks ago in Russia. And this story is principally about an incident that took place in, I believe you said, 1966 in the old Soviet Union.
The Russian incident was October 4th, 1982.
82. Okay. Well, the 66 was Minot.
Correct.
Yeah, Minot was 66. Okay. So we've got on both sides of the pond here, we've got weird stuff happening. In the old Soviet Union, you've got UFOs hovering over nuclear facilities and missile bases. You've got this story that was published about all of the missiles going ready for launch for about 15 seconds, that they were in their beginning launch sequence for about 15 seconds and then shut down.
Correct.
On this side of the pond, we've got missiles that I know I'm not using the correct terminology, Bob Salas, but they're on standby. In other words, they're ready to launch. All you have to do is put the codes in and turn the key or whatever, and they're ready to go. So they're standing at the ready, and they shut down so that you could not launch them.
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, we were just talking about telephone problems, and Bob Hastings said that, it's sort of a... Sometimes it's just kind of a message to him that, hey, we're here, we're listening, and don't get too big. What about this stuff with the UFOs and missiles beginning to launch and then missiles shutting down where they can't be launched? Is this a message from the UFOs? Are they trying to send a message here? And if so, what's the message?
Who are you asking?
Either one.
Okay, well, I can answer from my perspective. I think Robert and I are on the same page here, but there have been so many of these incidents worldwide, UFOs interfering with missile systems, that I think there is a message, and the message they're trying to send us is, let's get rid of your nuclear weapons, or asking us to get rid of our nuclear weapons. I strongly believe that. It just seems to be, Robert can verify that in many of these cases, they simply send a beam of light down and over some of these missiles, just as a kind of an indicator, a pointer, if you will, saying, just get rid of your nuclear weapons. Otherwise, the possibility you could just simply annihilate yourselves. And I think the world is finally getting that message too. And I'm really heartened to see that we have agreed with Russia to have a strategic arms limitation treaty. Of course, it's being held up by our Senate. It hasn't been ratified yet, so I personally would sure like to see that treaty go forward and get to the point where we're headed towards abolishing all nuclear weapons.
Bob Hastings, what do you think about it? Is it a message from the UFOs? And if so, what do you think the message is?
I agree with everything you said. I think that the based on the available fact, the most plausible scenario is that whoever are flying these things are wagging a finger at us and the Russians, certainly probably other nuclear powers as well, basically saying, you're playing with fire, this will ultimately be your doom if you don't get rid of nukes. Over the years, I've interviewed more than 120 former or retired Air Force personnel, and I just ask these people who've had these experiences like Mr. Salas, what their opinions are about what they experience, what it all means, what it adds up to. Three quarters of them, roughly 75% of those people that I've interviewed, share the opinion that Bob and I have, is that these guys, whoever they are wagging a finger at us and the Russians and saying, you know, get rid of nukes. Now, people have said to me in my lecture audiences, okay, well, why don't they just land on the White House lawn and in the courtyard and say, you know, get rid of your nukes? I think that would suggest that the fact that they haven't, that there's a larger agenda, a bigger picture. I think they ultimately plan open contact with humankind, but they're not ready just yet. But they see enough danger, potential catastrophe in the nuclear arms race, that they feel they have to engage in the stealthy, behind-the-scenes behavior out at missile sites and weapons storage areas just to sort of get their message across to the Pentagon, to the Kremlin. You know, this is something we're keeping an eye on and we're not terribly happy about. But the way they pursued it, you know, the public at large has no clue about this going on. If it were not for people such as myself and Mr. Salas, who've gone forward and tried to bring this to the public's attention, you know, we think quite clearly this is something the American public and, in fact, every human on the planet needs to know has been going on. So that's my take on it.
I've heard that as well about, well, why don't they just land on the White House lawn? And, you know, to me, that honestly sounds like the second most foolish question anybody can ask. I think the stupidest question anybody can ask is, do you believe in UFOs? There's nothing to believe. They either exist or they don't. And if they do, there's nothing to believe. You know, it's just a fact. But the second stupidest question I've ever heard, I would put it as number two, is why don't they land on the White House lawn? And the reason I think that's so foolish is, why should they care about the White House? That's important to us, but why should they care?
I think they're savvy enough to know that if they suddenly fly in the face of humanity in one fell swoop, so to speak, there could be panic, there could be adverse consequences, whereas if they engage in a decades-long, maybe 100-year long, slow preparation process whereby they allow themselves to be seen, and then they kind of go away and they're out of consciousness, and they allow us to sort of digest what has happened, then they're back again. These periodic mass sightings over large metropolitan areas like Phoenix and Mexico City and so on, slowly but surely more and more people are getting used to the reality of the situation. They're real and they're here. But I think that slow acclimation, that slow psychological conditioning over decades, is probably a much more logical and less potentially dangerous way of interacting with a new species that you're opening yourself with. So the fact that skeptics or people who are just generally impatient say, damn it, they're real, they should land and let themselves be known, I think there are consequences involved with that kind of, one-off, I mean, that kind of abrupt, confrontational revelation of themselves.
Bob Salas, you were very much involved in this UFO incident at Malmstrom Air Force Base, but you were underground, so you didn't see it. Have you ever seen a UFO?
I can't say that I have. You know, I've seen strange-looking lights in the sky, but no, I can't say that I have had actually seen one.
Is there any doubt in your mind as to whether they exist?
No doubt at all. No doubt at all.
And you base that upon the evidence that surrounded the incident that you were involved in, and that evidence being, one, what the guards up top were calling down to you, and two, what you were seeing on your instruments, correct?
Well, it's not just that. The certainly the situation that I went through was very convincing. These objects did exist out there. I went through some pretty extensive training, in the system Minuteman system, and I knew how reliable it was, and I knew how, you know, how things worked. What these objects were able to do was to penetrate some 60 feet of Earth and then penetrate a triply protected cabling systems, and somehow send a signal to each one of those missiles to shut them down. I mean, it's just fantastic what the technology that they have was able to accomplish. That combined with the fact that it not only happened at my facility, but at the Echo flight, as I mentioned, these were on two separate days and two separate facilities. The reports of UFOs have been well documented at both facilities. There's absolutely no question that these objects are real. It's a real phenomenon, and the government is holding back the truth for whatever reason. They're not allowing the public to get involved in the conversation. Really, it's and that's why we're fighting so hard to get the truth out. That's one of the reasons, and in my case, I'm fighting so hard, is I don't want to see a secret organization, either in or out of government, controlling this information.
That's right. Bob, since my conversation about the press conference was breaking up, why don't you take this opportunity to reiterate what I said a few minutes ago, and hopefully the message will get across to Kevin's listeners uninterrupted.
Okay, well, you know, of course, excuse me, the press conference will be held in Washington, D.C. on September 27th. I think we're going to start about noon, and we're going to invite the world press. We will have press kits for every press credentialed person.
All right, we have to step away for break. When we come back, we're going to start right there and hear about this press conference. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Robert Hastings and Robert Salas. We're talking about this, I think, very important, and well documented, I think, situation of UFOs interacting with military at military bases, kept very secret from the public. But these two gentlemen have done a lot in getting the word out to the public. And we were just about to hear from Bob Salas about this press conference, September the 27th in Washington, D.C. And we had to go to break. So, Bob Salas, go ahead and tell us about it again.
Okay. We're going to have about eight ex-military witnesses who were stationed at sites that had nuclear weapons facilities, and had UFO encounters there, and all these men have been vetted by us. We've retrieved their DD-214s, which are the Air Force records, and their testimonies are going to be written down on affidavits signed. So these are authentic witnesses, and we hope that it will get well publicized.
And let me ask you a question about this now. You had, when this incident took place back in 1967 at Malmstrom Air Force Base, you're underground, you're at a missile installation, you're underground, you see it happen. You don't see the UFO, but you're looking at the instruments, and you see the ability to launch these missiles basically die in front of your eyes. After this, you were told you were called into your commander's office. There was an OSI agent there. He presents each of you with a piece of paper that you had to sign saying that you would not talk about this forever. I think it's perhaps the case with most of the witnesses that you're going to present at this press conference that they probably underwent something very similar. Now, you decided to come out and talk about it. Did you have any fear that that paper you signed would be used against you and that they would prosecute you?
Well, I'll tell you the situation. I didn't talk about this for many years. I didn't talk to anybody about this until in 1994, I believe it was. I was in a bookstore in Seattle and picked up a book called Above Top Secret by Timothy Good. I happened to turn to page 301, I think it is, and in there he describes, Timothy Good describes an incident at Malmstrom Air Force Base where 10 missiles shut down after a UFO was overhead, reported overhead. Well, I got excited because that's the same thing that happened to me. So I figured they were talking about my incident, and somehow the Air Force, Timothy Good, got the Air Force to declassify the incident. So I wrote to the Air Force under the Freedom of Information Act. We didn't mention anything about UFOs, but we asked for documents concerning these missile shutdowns in 1967. And the Air Force wrote back and said, this incident is still classified. However, since you asked for information, and so much time has gone by, we're going to declassify this incident, and we're going to send you documents. So they did. They started sending us documents related to the Echo flight shutdown. I think I mentioned that the Echo flight went down on the 16th of March, but I hadn't mentioned anything about UFOs, but as a result of that, I decided to go public because I thought that was my incident at the time. As it turned out, I found out later when I contacted Fred Maiwald, who was my commander at Oscar flight. We were at Oscar. We weren't at Echo when our thing went down. So by that time, it was too late. I'd already been on the Art Bell show. I'd been on sightings, and so I was out there. So was I a little nervous? Maybe a little bit. But, excuse me. Pardon me. Maybe a little nervous, but I didn't let it stop me. I decided to keep going forward.
Have you heard of any of these others that have come forward and started talking about this? Have you heard of any of them having any harassment for having come forward?
I'm sure people have been harassed for coming forward. I can tell you in my case, I can tell you a short story. I don't know if you might consider this harassment, but I did. In 1969, I left Great Falls of Malmstrom Air Force Base and went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to finish up my master's degree in engineering. And not long after I got to the base, I was told to report to the base psychiatrist. And I certainly hadn't complained about any psychiatric or mental problem. So I thought it was really strange, but I had this, looked like an official order to report to the base psychiatrist. So I went over to the hospital, and the orderly comes out, wants to take me back to see the base psychiatrist, and I said, "What's this all about?" And he said, "Well, the psychiatrist will tell you all about it." And I said, "No, thanks. I don't think so." And so I just turned around and walked out. And the reason I mention this is because Other people that we've talked to have been threatened that if they did talk about their incident, there would be a record in their files of having psychiatric problems. And even today, there's a program called the PRP, or Personnel Reliability Program, I think it's called, in the Air Force, where they evaluate airmen working around nuclear weapons as to whether or not they are reliable individuals, so to speak. And, if they reported a UFO, they probably wouldn't be considered reliable. So that's another way they pressure people in the Air Force now, in the military, to keep quiet.
So there's a program in place to force people to lie.
Okay. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The problem with that, there are many problems with it, but the biggest problem is if you force people to lie about various things, you really cannot expect them to tell you the truth about everything else.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Air Force has been covering this thing up for a long time, and the problem is that there's becoming a large body of individuals that know something about the truth. And these individuals aren't going to be in the Air Force forever, and some of them are going to have the courage to come forward. It's just going to happen. And then when that body of people gets to this critical stage, I think that's the time that there will be a lot of pressure on the government to tell the truth.
Robert Hastings, we're going to give your telephone another try here. What's the purpose of this press conference? What is it you want to achieve with this press conference?
I think Hastings has dropped off. He may be having trouble with his phone.
He may be. All right. Let me ask you then, Robert Salas, what is it that you hope to achieve with this press conference?
Informing the public, basically. We just want to inform the public. If we can get some people writing, in mainstream media, so to speak, and talking about this publicly. And, you know, we've got some pretty credible people coming out. These aren't crazy people. You know,
mm-hmm.
Those have been in institutions, well-educated people, and there's absolutely no reason for them to be making these stories up. Like Mr. Hastings said, none of us are making any money off this. Believe me, I've been in this for 15 years talking about it. I really haven't made anything as far as money goes from doing that. We're all doing it because we're committed and we're sincere. We're telling the truth. We just want the public to know the truth.
How do you think the public is better off by knowing the truth? And I agree with the idea that we are better off, but why do you think we're better off if we know the truth about UFOs and their interaction with the military?
Well, the reason basically is we're supposed to have a representative government. Government of the people, by the people, for the people, and the people should be informed. How can you have a good government without an informed electorate? And especially something of this magnitude. It's we're talking about other civilizations and other parts of the universe, or maybe our own solar system. Who knows where they're from? But we cannot allow a cabal, a secret group of people, to control this information, to deal with these beings, whatever they are, without public consent. Otherwise, what have you got? You've got a monarchy. You've got an autocracy. You've got some kind of government that history has told us we don't want. None of us want that kind of a government.
Well, I think UFO secrecy has been one of the most destructive secrets that the U.S. government has ever tried to keep. I think UFO secrecy has shredded the Constitution in many, many cases. But let me ask you this. Do you think, and this is going a little beyond what we were talking about here, but do you think there's any credibility to the stories that that we have had actual contact with these beings? For instance, the story about Ike Eisenhower meeting with these aliens, and then the tons of stories by ex-military people who say that they have seen and met with aliens on military bases. What do you think? Any credibility to that?
Well, I certainly think there's credibility to the Roswell case. And in that case, people do report seeing beings, although it was a crash. Now, whether or not there was actually a case where, such as the Ike case, where being UFOs landed and some kind of a meeting, and you know, your guess is as good as mine as to whether or not that's valid.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on final approach. That means we only have a few minutes left here, and then we will hit the brick wall at the end of the show. We were able to reestablish contact with Robert Hastings. Let me just check and see if we still have contact with him. Robert Hastings, are you still with us? Okay.
So far, knock wood.
Okay, very good. Are you on the same cell phone?
I am.
Well, it's a much clearer connection now. All right. I want to ask you what I just asked Bob Salas, and that is, what do you hope to achieve with this press conference? What is it you're trying to accomplish with this?
We are of the opinion that if indeed beings from other worlds, and that seems to be the best explanation for what's going on, if they're here, and if they're monitoring and tampering with our nuclear weapons, and if we have witnesses over a 60-year period from the 40s until the present day saying that this continues to go on, that is obviously something that American citizens need to know, people everywhere in the world need to know. The best way to achieve the spreading of this message is to get the media interested in a single place, a single location, and have, again, you know, 8 to 10 people who were entrusted by the U.S. government with weapons of mass destruction. They were vetted, they are credible witnesses, and they're all talking about UFOs, monitoring, and even shutting down our nuclear weapons. That is something that has to be told. That is a story that needs to get out. And so we're attempting as best as possible to utilize the media to spread our message across the planet. Honest goal.
All right. Now, let me ask you what I asked Bob Salas. I said, I think UFO secrecy has been one of the most destructive secrets that the U.S. government has ever tried to keep. Because in trying to keep it a secret, in my opinion, they have shredded the Constitution again and again. But do you think there's any validity to these stories about aliens having met face-to-face with U.S. personnel? In one case, the story is it was President Eisenhower. And then there are other stories about other people. What do you think? Any validity to these stories?
Speaking for myself, I think I have not yet heard a single story that had credibility along those lines. part of the problem is the government itself is spreading disinformation to sort of muddy the waters. I was actually actively involved in exposing a disinformation scheme that was being run out of Kirtland Air Force Base, OSI, Office of Special Investigations, in the 1980s. One of the primary people involved is a retired Air Force sergeant named Richard Doty, who has belatedly admitted that they were forging documents. They were spreading BS to people like Linda Howe and others about all manner of nonsense, just to try to muddy the waters about what the Air Force knows about UFOs, what went on at Roswell, and so on. And so when you get back to a lot of the nonsense that you see on the internet now about the kinds of stories you're mentioning about underground alien bases, about ongoing contact between aliens and the government, you can trace that back to, if one is willing to do the research and do the diligent work, you can trace 99% of that back to disinformation schemes being operated out of Kirtland Air Force Base in the late 80s, in the 1980s. And so you really have to be careful to separate the wheat from the chaff when you're talking about these kinds of things. So I'm personally unaware of any credible story from any credible source about face-to-face meetings with aliens and some president or another.
Well, assuming there are no actual face-to-face meetings, and that this is disinformation, perhaps, and I'm just speculating, perhaps the reason to spread the disinformation, if the truth were known, the truth would include the fact that we don't know what the heck these things are, we don't know who these people are, we can't control our airspace, and we're charging you trillions of dollars for doing it. And they can't admit that. And so perhaps the purpose of the disinformation is to make it appear, hey, we're buddies with these guys, but we can't tell you about it.
I would recommend to your listeners that they Google Victor Marchetti, M-A-R-C-H-E-T-T-I. He was a former high-level CIA official who wrote an article in 1979 called How the CIA Views the UFO Phenomenon. And Mr. Marchetti basically, long story short, broke with the CIA. He thought that they were engaged in illegal and immoral activity and really talked about any number of things that they were involved in. But in this article, he basically said that if any government knows about UFOs, the reality of it, even if whoever these guys are, aren't hostile, if the aliens aren't hostile, every government, the government on Earth has more to lose than they do to gain by talking about this. They upset the status quo. They risk losing their power base, the whatever control they have over their own citizens, by admitting that a new paradigm is here and things are going to change one way or the other. If not in the next 5 years, certainly within the next 50, I think this will be common knowledge. So that is an authoritative source talking about how the government views the UFO phenomenon and why they act the way they do. Lots of people blow smoke about their secret inside sources and the real UFO story and all that. Well, unlike all that nonsense, Mr. Marchetti is a credible source whose story you can take to the bank.
Well, I certainly think they do, from their standpoint, from their viewpoint, have more to lose than they have to gain. And one of the things they have to lose is their own personal freedom for the crimes they've committed and keeping it a secret. That's part of it, yeah. And that's the most important part to them personally. Their own personal freedom is much more important to them than anything else. But the thing is, it is going to blow. The public doesn't buy these spin stories anymore.
Right.
They come out with a spin story and the public chuckles. Everybody knows that it's a spin story, that it's a lie. And the public is way ahead of the government on this story.
It's taken decades, but that seems to be the direction we're heading, thank God. I think there are, in America, certainly a lot of traditionally religious people who believe that UFOs don't exist because of the way they interpret the Bible. There's no place for them. And I've talked to people who have told me just that. So I think if you look at public opinion polls in recent years, roughly one out of two Americans believe that UFOs exist, and a larger percentage believe that the government's not telling the truth. However, I think the numbers getting much beyond 50%, one out of two people who accept the reality of this, is probably going to be an uphill climb, because there are large numbers of people in America who do believe that the Bible says that the only intelligent life in the universe is here on Earth, and that God, made us in His image, and there's no room for intelligent beings elsewhere. That's how they interpret the Bible. So I think those people, until they see, something that resembles concrete proof, they're not going to change. So there's always that factor that really will prevent, 100% of Americans believing this sooner or later, I think.
Well, I don't think 100% of Americans are ever going to buy into anything. We're kind of a rebellious people, and if you have two of us in a room, there are at least three opinions. Well, guys, we've almost run out of time. I just want to say how much I appreciate you being with us this evening. I want to highlight again what you said about the press conference, September the 27th. I think this is going to be a big, big deal, this press conference. And if you will click either one of these gentlemen's pictures on my website, folks, if you click their picture, it will take you to Robert Hastings' website, where if you want to donate toward the expenses of having this press conference, you may do so, okay? So you just click on his picture or on Robert Salas' picture. It will take you to where you can make the donation if you want to do so. And, by the way, there's a whole lot more stuff on his website. Gentlemen, stay on the telephone line with me for just a moment, if you will. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. I hope you've enjoyed the show. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.